Tebhyaha.
Unto the Brahmanas.
Zatva.
After supplying.
Bhagavat Arpanam.
Which was first offered to the personality of Godhead.
Go.
Cows.
Vipra.
Brahmanas.
Artha.
Purpose.
Asavaha.
Purpose of living.
Shuraha.
All the valiant Kshatriyas.
Pranemohu.
Offered obeisances.
Bhuvi.
Touching the ground.
Murdabihi.
With their heads. Translation.
Thereafter, they offered the Brahmanas highly delicious foodstuffs, first offered to the personality of Godhead,
and offered their respectful obeisances by touching their heads to the ground. They lived perfectly by protecting the cows and the Brahmanas. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
The behavior exhibited by the descendants of Yadu in the pilgrimage site of Prabhas was highly cultured and exactly to the point of human perfection. The perfection of human life is attained by following three principles of civilization: protecting the cows, maintaining the Brahminical culture, and above all, becoming a pure devotee of the Lord. Without becoming a devotee of the Lord, one cannot perfect one's human life. The perfection of human life is to be elevated to the spiritual world, where there is no birth, no death, no disease, and no old age. That is the highest perfectional aim of human life. Without this aim, any amount of material advancement in so-called comforts can only bring about the defeat of the human form of life. Brahmanas and Vaishnavas do not accept any foodstuff which is not first offered to the personality of Godhead. Foodstuff offered to the Lord is accepted by the devotees as the mercy of the Lord. After all, the Lord supplies all kinds of foodstuff, both to the human being and to other animals. A human being must be conscious of the fact that all foodstuffs, namely grains, vegetables, milk, water, etc., the prime necessities of life, are supplied for mankind by the Lord. And such foodstuffs cannot be manufactured by any scientist or materialist in a laboratory or factory established by human effort. The intelligent class of men are called Brahmanas, and those who have realized the absolute truth and His supreme personal feature are called Vaishnavas. But both of them accept foodstuffs, which are the remnants of sacrifice. Sacrifice is ultimately meant to satisfy the Yajna Purusha, Vishnu. In Bhagavad Gita, in the third chapter, text 13, it is said that one who accepts foodstuffs as the remnants of sacrifice is freed from all sinful reactions, and one who cooks foodstuffs for maintenance of his body takes in all kinds of sins, which lead only to suffering. The foodstuffs prepared by the Yadus at the Prabhas pilgrimage site to offer to the bona fide Brahmanas there were all offered to the personality of Godhead Vishnu. The Yadus offer their sincere obeisances by touching their heads to the ground. The Yadus, or any enlightened family in Vedic culture, are trained for attainment of human perfection by total cooperation and service between the different divisions of social orders. The word Uru Arasam is also significant here. Hundreds of delicacies can be prepared simply by the combination of grains, vegetables, and milk. All such preparations are in the mode of goodness and therefore may be offered to the personality of Godhead. As stated in Bhagavad Gita in the 9th chapter, text 26, the Lord accepts only foodstuffs which are within the range of fruits, flowers, leaves, and liquids, provided they are offered in complete devotional service. Devotional service is the only criterion for a bona fide offering to the Lord. The Lord assures that He positively eats such foodstuffs offered by the devotees. So judging from all sides, the Yadus were perfectly trained, civilized persons, and their being cursed by the Brahmana sages was only by the desire of the Lord. The whole incident was a warning to all concerned
that no one should behave lightly with brahmanas and Vaishnavas. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the third canto, third chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam entitled The Lord's Pastimes Out of Vrindavan. So, anam charurasam tebyo tatva bhagavadarpanam govipratasavashura pranemurmuvi murdabhi. So, Prabhupada's picture. Omagana timiranda shah gananjana shlakaya chakshur miditam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So, of course, this is a verse about prasadam, which everybody likes, hopefully. So, the word prasadam, we know, means the mercy of the Lord. It's not simply a synonym for food. And when we take prasadam, Prabhupada has instructed us not only to offer first the foodstuffs to Krishna, but to say this interesting prasadam prayer. And most of the devotees, they know how to say it in Bengali, but they don't know the meaning of it. I've seen that many times, that you see, they go, Shrira, Vijaja, etc., etc. And I said, what does it mean? And they say, well, I don't know. We're supposed to say it. But it's actually a prayer to the Lord to help us control our senses. And of course, it starts that this material body is a lump of ignorance, and the senses are networks of paths leading to death of all the senses, as we know. The tongue is the most voracious and uncontrollable. And Krishna has been so kind to us to send us this Bhagavad Prasadam to help us control the tongue. And so let us take this Prasadam and love call out for Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda to please help us. In the beginning of the movement, we would always say it in English. But as we become more sophisticated, we've forgotten the meaning of everything. So that's called Niyam Agraha. You understand Niyam Agraha? And even when we offer the food, we forget to be devotional. It's a real problem that occurs as we become more sophisticated in devotional service, and that we don't remember the purpose of everything. And as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that one could offer him a leaf, fruit, or water with love and devotion, but it has to be offered with love and devotion. That's the operative phrase there. Operative phrase means love and devotion. And of course, I can say for my own part, I don't have too much love or devotion, so I pray to Prabhupada when I do my offering so that Prabhupada will make the offering to Krishna. And based upon one's consciousness, Krishna can either accept the food or not accept the food. It's not that Krishna is duty-bound to accept food that's offered to him. If you're a pure devotee, yes, he's duty-bound. That's one of the qualities of pure devotional service. According to Srila Rupa Goswami, is that Krishna's controlled by devotion. But I don't think Krishna's controlled by my devotion or whatever attitude I have. So we have to be very careful to have the right consciousness when offering. I mean, we've had some experiences in doing deity service that after the offering is made, not by me, I wasn't the one making the offering. And sometimes the pujari would go on the altar and find everything on the floor. In other words, the deities just threw everything on the floor because they didn't need it. And Prabhupada said that Krishna doesn't have to accept. And especially if you're offering to Radha and Krishna, you know, if it's not done, you know, cleanly, punctually, with the right consciousness, you know, Radharani will not allow Krishna to take it. Because the kitchen is actually Radharani's place. And the kitchen is actually part of the altar. It's a very important consciousness to have. And Prabhupada, of course, said the whole temple, and what to speak of the kitchen and the altar, should be revolutionary clean. So Prabhupada established the minimum standards of cleanliness and punctuality in deity worship so that the Lord would accept things. Of course, if one has absolute pure devotion, then one doesn't have to follow all these rules and regulations, and Krishna will accept, like the story of Raghunandana in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Raghunandana is the son of Mukunda, who is a physician. And Mukunda sometimes had to go out and do some work, being a physician. And he had these deities of Radha and Krishna. And when he went out to do his work, one time he told his son, Raghunandana, who was just a very, very young boy, to take care of the deities, make sure that Krishna's offering is there. So Raghunandana didn't know any of the procedures in deity worship, certainly didn't know any of the mantras or anything like that. So he cooked the food, but with love and devotion, and he put it on the altar, and he didn't know how to offer, so he just said, "Krishna, eat." And when he didn't see Krishna eating, he started crying, and some stories say that he even threatened Krishna, some of the stories, but at least he started crying and yelling or whatever, and then Krishna really got down from the altar and started eating. And so he was very happy. So his father came back. Mukunda came back and he said, "How did the offerings go? Was there any Mahaprasadam?" And Raghunandana said to his father, "There's no Mahaprasadam because Krishna ate everything." And Mukunda said, "That's not the way Krishna eats." And he began to recite this verse from the Brahma Sanhita, "Angani Yasha Shakalan Driya Driti Manti." You know, Krishna can do anything with any one of his senses, so he eats with his eyes and his ears on the altar, and he leaves it all over for us. And Raghunandana said, "No, that's not how things go." You know, he saw so much devotion he had. And Mukunda said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Krishna got down and he ate everything on his plate." Mukunda couldn't believe what he was hearing. He said, "All right, show me." So he stood by the window of the temple room and watched as Raghunandana made this offering of some laddus to Krishna. So because Krishna had eaten so much in the previous meal, he was so satisfied taking the prasadam that Raghunandana offered, he couldn't eat much of the laddu. He just ate half of the laddu. And then Mukunda saw that happening, and he offered obeisances to his son. And he said to his son, basically, "You're a better devotee than me." And later on, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked Mukunda, "Is Raghunandana your son?" This is from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. "Or are you Raghunandana's son?" You know, externally, Raghunandana obviously was his son, a younger kid. But then Mukunda replied, "No, I am Raghunandana's son, and Raghunandana is the father." So accepting him is more advanced in devotional service because he was able to get the Lord to go down, go off the altar and eat. Pretty interesting story. So that's devotion. We can't do that. Can't do that. Although sometimes I've also experienced, not when I did the offering, of course, that sometimes you go on the altar and the food is half eaten. Or the cups are like half empty. I mean, you're sure you filled the cups up, the bowls up, and they're half empty when you go on the altar. So that we've seen that happen sometimes too. So if you have that sort of devotion, I wouldn't worry so much about punctuality. Another story, of course, is a devotee who had loved Krishna so much that he was in so much ecstasy that he forgot that he was offering Krishna the banana peels rather than the bananas, and Krishna accepted. So this is highly unusual, all these different stories. So we have to really be careful and follow carefully the Pancharatrika Vidhi, because we're, at least most of us, myself, we're on the platform of Vaidhi Bhakti, which means rules and regulations, and that means that we go to our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada's representatives to make the offerings to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And another important point about prasadam or food in general is that the person who is cooking the food, his consciousness actually enters into the food. That's why it's very important to have the person with the right consciousness doing the cooking. And that's why it's very important to eat food. Prabhupada said, "Food cooked by devotees." That's one of the first things that Prabhupada said. You should not eat food cooked by non-devotees. It was actually on the injunctions that Srila Prabhupada wrote and posted. A devotee does not eat food cooked by non-devotees, because what happens if you eat food cooked by non-devotees, the mind becomes wicked. And the perfect example of that is in the Mahabharata, where you have grandfather Bhishma, Dronacharya and Kripacharya. They were eating food cooked in Duryodhana's kitchen. And it's not that Duryodhana was the cook, but you can imagine if Duryodhana was so bad, he must have hired the wrong type of cook too. So Let's go back in that story in the Mahabharata. It's a very interesting story. That once upon a time, the Pandavas, this is during the Pandavas' exile, Duryodhana, he wanted to sort of make the Pandavas feel real bad and show off in front of them. So he brought his whole entourage, as they were in the woods. This is not during the period of exile when they had to be incognito. But so he went into the woods with all of his paraphernalia to a lake where the Pandavas were to show off. So when he got there, he discovered the Gandharvas were there. And he challenged the Gandharvas. He got arrested by the Gandharvas. And basically, they weren't going to let him go. Eventually, Yudhisthira said to Arjuna to go to the Gandharvas and arrange for the release of Duryodhana because he's our brother. And the other Pandavas were sort of shocked at this, thinking, you know, how can Yudhisthira do this? But Yudhisthira, he was a jata shatrava, which means he who has no enemy. So he asked them to do that. So they released Duryodhana, and Duryodhana was so depressed after this, he decided to commit suicide. He sat down in a meditative trance, thinking, I'm going to leave my body, give up eating, give up everything, because, you know, my whole mission is unsuccessful. Actually, Duryodhana was an incarnation of Kali, you know, the Kali Yuga, as we know it. So then the demons took him out of his body and gave him a pep talk. You know, like before a football game or something like that, you have a pep talk with the players. They said, don't worry, we're going to be able to enter into the consciousness, to take over the consciousness of Grandfather Bhishma, Dronacharya, and Kripacharya. And so Duryodhana felt very much enlivened at that point. He came back to external consciousness, said Haribol, or whatever demons say when they come back to external consciousness. And obviously he didn't say Haribol. He said, Jai demon, you know, whatever. So he came back and then he understood what was going to happen. And this actually is what happened, because Grandfather Bhishma, Dronacharya, Kripacharya were eating this impure food. And their consciousness became so contaminated that demons could actually possess them. That's what the Mahabharata says. It's not my philosophy. And this is very much in line with what Prabhupada said. You know, you eat food cooked by non-devotees, your mind becomes wicked. That means so many desires come up. Now, why is that? You know, physiologically, according to the Ayurvedas, there's a reason for that. The reason for that is when you eat food, it's transformed to blood eventually. And the blood is the carrier of consciousness. So the food is floating in the blood or transformed into the blood, and then it affects the consciousness. I mean, that's easy to understand Ayurvedically. So later on, so they opposed the Pandavas, and Grandfather Bhishma lost his intelligence as to what was right and what was wrong. This is another major topic of the Mahabharata concerning morality, whether it's the result of the action that's moral or the action itself. You understand? That's called consequentialism. The results of the action. That's one of the main underlying topics of the Mahabharata. Is the action, like, I'll give you an example of that. Grandfather Bhishma made a promise to always to support Dhritarashtra. So to him, that was the highest morality. So in following that particular promise, he allowed the attempted disrobing of Draupadi. So it's interesting. He allowed irreligion in the name of religion because he was attached to the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. So the end of the Mahabharata, you have Krishna instructing Grandfather Bhishma, and Grandfather Bhishma realizing that it was actually the ultimate morality is the result of one's action, you know, determined by the results of one's action rather than the action itself. I mean, for example, the example given in the Mahabharata is that you can lie sometimes to protect someone. The example was that
Once upon a time, there were a bunch of dacoits attacking a family. The family took shelter in the hermitage of a sage. And the dacoits came to the sage and said, "My dear sage, where is this family?" And the sage said, "I can't tell a lie. They're in my hermitage. They're in my ashram." And the dacoits killed the family. So he told the truth, but he was committing irreligion. And so Grandfather Bhishma, because he was possessed like that, he lost, even though he's a Mahajan, remember this, Grandfather Bhishma was not like us. He was one of the Dwadasa, that means the 12 great Mahajanas. He lost his whole understanding of religion and irreligion. And he took, you know, irreligion to be religion and religion to be irreligion. It's a very interesting study in morality. So then he allowed the disrobing or attempt to disrobe Draupadi and many other things. He fought against the Pandavas in the Battle of Kurukshetra just to try to keep his so-called promise. On the other hand, when Krishna came to try to make peace between the Pandavas and Kurus, and Krishna was offered food by Duryodhana, Krishna said, "No, I'm not going to take all this opulent food," because Duryodhana had very opulent food to offer, just like it's being described here in this verse about the rasa. Rasa, of course, means taste. Uru rasam means highly delicious food. So the word rasa actually means taste. It doesn't mean relationship. And in rasa theology, it means the taste of a relationship. So Krishna came, and he was offered all this opulent food by Duryodhana, and Krishna said, "No, I'm not going to take any of your food." And instead, he just took very simple, what's described sometimes as porridge, that was offered by Vidura. He went to Vidura's home and he just said, porridge means like oatmeal or something like that. And so he was satisfied just by that simple porridge because it was offered with love and devotion. So, I mean, what does this mean to us? That means that we have to be very careful. I mean, I've seen also as devotees go on year after year in Krishna consciousness, their strictness insofar as their eating habits becomes diminished. And Prabhupada one time said jokingly that my disciples, they'll eat any damn thing. And of course, in the beginning days, people weren't so strict and the devotees would eat in the donut shop right next to the temple, 26 Second Avenue. And that's why Prabhupada said one time jokingly, "We have so many donuts or do nots in our Krishna consciousness movement." And when Prabhupada would walk by this donut shop, the devotees would slump down in their chairs so we wouldn't see them through the window. Imagine, you know, right next to 26 Second Avenue. So it's important for us to become very strict. I've seen devotees like buy, you know, chips or even go to McDonald's and not buy Big Macs or anything like that, but buy French fries, which are cooked in God knows what oil. And, you know, I'm sure there's some beef stuff in there somewhere. So, and what is the consciousness of the people preparing it? What are the ingredients that are going into it? And that's one reason why devotees are not so determined or strict anymore in their devotional service, because their minds become affected by these different things. You know, I talk to devotees sometimes, and they say, "Well, we went to the restaurant last night." I said, "What restaurant? Hare Krishna restaurant?" "No, beefsteak restaurant." "Well, we had a salad, you know." So this is extremely important if we want to maintain our Brahminical principles. Prabhupada said here, "Brahmins and Vaishnavas do not accept any foodstuff which is not first offered to the personality of Godhead." And, of course, Krishna says, if you're eating food not offered, you're verily eating sin. I mean, that's the English Bhagavad Gita. That means you're getting karma, but your consciousness is getting affected, and you're going to do more karma because of that. I'll tell you a very interesting story in my own life. When I first started traveling with Sri Dayananda Maharaj many years ago, this is before any of you were born, in the Middle Ages, I guess, or something, around the time of Galileo,
It's like when we first started traveling, he just took sannyasa and I was his brahmachari assistant. This was in 1972 or something like that, a long time ago. And so he said to me, it was very interesting, he said, now that I'm a sannyasi, he's a sannyasi, I wasn't a sannyasi then, but you're traveling with sannyasi, you know, we don't have to be so strict in our eating habits. So we can, you know, or we don't have to wake up early in the morning anymore. Pretty good. Taking sannyasi, you know, you renounce from Vayubhakti, so it doesn't work like that. So, but anyway, there were some misunderstandings about sannyasi in the early days. And so he said, you know, we can just eat anything as long as it's not meat, fish, or eggs. And wake up any time in the morning. So, all right, so I said, I thought, this is great, you know, because one of the most difficult things I had to accept in joining the Krishna Conscious Movement was waking up early. You know, for me, early meant 9 o'clock in the morning. And that was because I was going to the university and class was there. So, and, you know, I would stay up till 1 o'clock at least. That was, the night was still young at that point, as you probably may remember. So, so I thought, boy, this is great, you know. So we would go into the supermarket to get our food as we were traveling, and we'd buy this whole bag of groceries, including dressing, you know, salad dressing that was made by, you know, God knows who, Kraft. You have Kraft here, I think, too. So Kraft, Thousand Island, salad dressing, you know, whatever, as long as it didn't have onions, garlic, meat, fish, or eggs in it. And we'd put the grocery bag up to our heads and go, Shivishnu, Shivishnu, Shivishnu. That was our offering. And then we'd buy this wheat bread and everything like in the store. And we'd sit down, we'd just like put it all out and we'd have a picnic between us. And I thought, this is great, you know. No more austerity in the Krishna Consciousness Movement, yeah. Being a sannyasi or a servant of a sannyasi is the perfection of human form of life. So what happened is after a few days, our consciousness started to go down. The first manifestation of that was that we started to yell at each other. Or he started to yell at me, I'm sorry. But because he was a sannyasi. I had such nectarian chastisement I had, I was told that I was the body rather than I wasn't the body. Anyway, you know, just out of chastisement. Everybody else is they're not their body, but you are your body. You're not qualified to be a sannyasi. It was just like, wow. Anyway, in those days, the sannyasis were rough and tough and a little bit different than now, kind, gentle, peaceful, loving, so empathic. So, you know, both of us, our consciousness went down and we noticed, you know, wow. We felt we had entered into the Mahatattva again, the material energy. So we became determined at that point to only eat food cooked by devotees. So we even took the austerity of rolling chapatis. You know, I had to be the cook, of course. Rolling chapatis on the wheel well of a van. You know, the vans, they have wheel wells in the back. So that was my rolling surface. And cooking with a gas stove. And the consciousness went up again. And then we remained Krishna conscious, or became Krishna conscious, as the case may be. And so that was our practical experience of the necessity of eating food cooked by devotees and how Krishna would only eat food cooked by devotees. So I think that lesson has actually been very important for me throughout my own Krishna consciousness. And not only do I only eat prasadam, food cooked by devotees, but I always make sure who is the cook. So I make sure that Krishna is accepting the prasadam. So these are some of the points. It was a prasadam class, since the verse and purport were out about the brahmanas. And some other points here in the verse, like principles of civilization, protecting the cows. Thank you. Maintaining Brahminical culture. Of course, Brahminical culture means samadhamatipakshocham, shakti rajavameva chagin, vijnanamastikyam, brahma karma subhavajam. Having the people in charge of society, not the administrators necessarily, who are peaceful, self-controlled, tolerant, etc., regularly reading the Vedic literatures. As Srila Prabhupada said, someone who doesn't read his books on a regular basis will go away. So the books are not meant simply for distribution, but they're actually meant for us to read on a regular basis. And then protecting the cows, that's one thing in ISKCON we really haven't done too well. Many of us are, you know, buying milk products without consideration of where they're coming from. So we may not be following that particular stricture too well. So these things are very, very important. The Prabhupada said these are essential aspects, these three principles of civilization. And in this way, and the Prabhupada said, above all, becoming a pure devotee of the Lord, which means following the sadhana process and serving the other devotees. Because that's the quickest way to become a pure devotee, is to serve other devotees. Not simply just the guru. That's a very important point I want to make to finish class, is that we sometimes think, well, we just serve our spiritual master, but serving all the devotees. One interesting experience I had recently when I was in Mayapur, I was serving one devotee as she was leaving her body. Her name was Mana Rupa. You probably have heard about that on the internet. She was she's the wife of Prahlad Nrisimha. I don't know if you know Prahlad Nrisimha. Anyway, she had cancer and she was leaving her body. So every day I would go there and read for her. And I experienced more taste for the holy name and spiritual enlivenment, happiness, reading for her than anything else I did in Mayapur last year, including going to the GBC meeting. Because I don't know if I should say I don't experience so much taste or ecstasy at the GBC meeting. It's a duty we perform for Prabhupada, which is important. But, you know, I definitely experienced that by serving just a simple, humble devotee, you know, rather than, you know, just some great devotee. I mean, she is a great devotee because she left her body in a completely Krishna-conscious way. But sometimes we see a great devotee in terms of externalities. You know, sometimes the purest devotee of the temple may be the cook in the kitchen or the person who's cleaning the bathrooms. Like in the case of Jayananda in San Francisco, the person who was fixing the cars. So we take things very externally. So, I mean, she was smiling up to the end and didn't complain, didn't go through any of the normal stages that hospice people say that people go through at the time of death. She was completely Krishna conscious. So anyway, by serving her in this way, I experienced so much happiness and Krishna consciousness. So that's a quick and easy way to become advanced devotee of the Lord. Mahat Seva Mahorvi Muktes. So these are some points. So any questions or comments?
What are the stages that one goes through in the
hospital? There's this nice devotee, Sangeeta. I don't know if you've heard. She's written this book about leaving, you know, how to take care of devotees when they leave their bodies. We've had many seminars in that. One stage is one is angry. You know, why me? The final stage is you're fighting against it. I've helped several devotees leave their bodies. That doesn't mean I'm doing euthanasia or anything. But I help them, you know, remain, you know, anyway. I actually like that service because it really gives me an opportunity to help devotees in a very deep way. So, and generally, people do go through those stages. There's anger, denial, and finally there's fighting. You know, I remember there was one girl, actually Lochan Prabhu's daughter, you know, Lochan who makes the murtis. The last day she was saying, I'm going to beat this. One day before she left her body, she said, I'm going to beat it, I'm going to live, and her cancer was very much progressed. She was taking, had a lot of morphine for pain relief. And basically, I had to help her at that point understand to let go. That's one of the things you do at the end when someone's ready to go. You say, just relax, you know, Prabhupada is waiting for you on the other side, there's something much better than this world, much better than being in this painful body. You know, you just have everything to look forward to. And so that's right after that she let go and left her body. So you give them, in other words, what you're doing is giving them permission to leave. That's a very important part in hospice.
Have you been present when somebody died?
Yeah, I was present when Gaur Govinda Maharaj left this world. And he,
he opened his mouth. You could see the soul, experience the soul come out of the body. His disciples were massaging his chest, and they had a picture of his deities in front of him, and he just left in such a... It was an ecstatic trance he left in. He was preaching Krishna consciousness, preaching about Krishna's, the Vipra Lumba Seva, the mood of separation from Krishna, and he just opened his mouth. I mean, and left his body. It's an amazing circumstance. In the case of this one devotee, Manarupa, she didn't go through any of those stages. She was happy, smiling the whole time, glowing, blissful. Other than Gaur Govinda Maharaj, I haven't seen anyone leave their body in such a way. Completely Krishna conscious. So, yeah. I mean, it's very important that we... one thing we've done, actually, in our temple in the United States, one of our temples, or several of the temples, we established these Vaishnava care committees where we meet regularly. In each geographical area, we have one committee. And we meet regularly to discuss how to care for the Vaishnavas or Vaishnavas in the hospital, not just leaving their bodies. But if Vaishnavas in the hospital, they have financial problems, family problems. You know, how are we going to help them? So we recently, one of my godbrothers passed away in North Carolina. His name is Lita Krishna. I don't know if you know, he's a disciple of Prabhupada. You know Lita Krishna. We had no less than like six or seven devotees with him, 24 hours a day in the hospice. And actually, it was almost too much, because at one point he got angry at us and he said, "You're all waiting for me to leave my body." You know, because devotees, I guess, were looking at their watches, when is he going to go? But devotees were around him 24 hours a day. And it really brought the whole community together. It's not just that it helped our individual Krishna consciousness, but each and every member of the community was tied together, and all the other conflicts we had were resolved by coming together and serving Vaishnavas in that condition.
So you had people that 24 hours?
Yeah, 24 hours a day. It's our community. It wasn't just the temple devotees. I mean, they were just...
It was in a hospital.
He was in a hospice.
A hospice. Uh-huh.
Hospice is a place where you go to leave your body.
But not a devotee run hospice.
No, but we've made arrangements with the hospice. So we have a very close relationship with the hospice, so we can do that. And they very much appreciate it. They said that they've never seen such things before in their hospice, where people were 24 hours a day, such, you know, and we were chanting, you know, I brought my guitar in.
So even when he slept, that you
were... Yeah, the buddies were there, chanting softly when he was sleeping. And it was a wonderful experience for the devotees. And then after that, we have devotees get together for mourning, you know, after his departure. And we have different groups. There's a man's group and a woman's group, you know, where they talk about these things. And it's really a community-building thing, too. And one of the things that we may lack in our movement is we don't have enough of this... loving exchanges between the devotees. And that's really what keeps the devotees in the movement. And I've actually lost devotees from the movement because when they were in the hospital, no devotee visited them. It happened in Fiji. One of my disciples became a Christian because the Christians went and comforted the person and none of the devotees did it. And when she got out of the hospital, she decided to be a Christian. So... Anyway, so the point is, by serving the Vaishnavas, you accomplish so many things. Your own Krishna consciousness becomes enhanced, and the community becomes enhanced, and more people join that want to join. I mean, who would not want to join a loving community where you're taken care of like that? So that's... Is it all right? So any other questions or comments? Yes?
I have heard that a sannyasi should only cook for himself.
Well, Prabhupada said that traditionally the brahmanas would only cook for themselves, that even they wouldn't eat what their wives cooked. And Prabhupada said that sometimes when they joined the Indian army, I don't know why brahmanas were in the army, but somehow or other, if they were in the army would make an arrangement for them to have separate stoves so they could cook for themselves. So that's a very nice standard. I mean, I know when I'm in my home base, I have a kitchen and I do cook for myself.
And guess whose cooking I like the best?
My,
as I guess whose cooking I like the best? Mine. Prabhupada said, if you cook for yourself, you'll like it.
And you will not get sick.
You will not get sick. Yeah. And so, yes, I don't get sick because I cook for myself. But as I travel, you know, people just insist upon cooking for me. I don't have access to a kitchen either. But I like...
We have one.
All right, so I'll start cooking. And then, I mean, I've even posted on YouTube cooking classes.
Oh.
Yeah, simple. You seen that, Jayananda, or something?
No.
On my YouTube channel.
Okay.
Cooking class. Because I like cooking. Prabhupada said only a lazy man can't cook. So, you know, Prabhupada said everyone should learn how to cook. I mean, it's a nice, it's a Brahminical skill. But, yes, traditionally it was even the Brahmanas who would not eat any food unless they cooked it. There's even that story in the Chaitanya Bhagavat about how that Brahmana was received by Jagannath Mishra, and they didn't cook for him in Jagannath Mishra's house. The Brahmana was given ingredients for cooking for his Gopal deity. And then, of course, the story goes that Krishna, that Lord Chaitanya kept stealing the offering. And but the point is the Brahmana didn't have anyone else cooking for him. He cooked for himself. Otherwise, he would just eat roots and fruits. It's an interesting story. That's a traditional Brahmana. We don't follow that system. I mean, we love the deity prasadam. You know, everybody shouldn't have their own kitchen in the temple. That would be counterproductive.
The danger when you cook for yourself is that you actually cook for yourself.
Yeah.
That's what Prabhupada says in the purport.
That's right. You're thinking that you're cooking for yourself rather than for the deities. You know, sometimes you hear people say, is it prasadam yet? You know, they're meditating on the food and they're saying, is it prasadam yet? Like the deity altar is like the checkout counter at the supermarket. You understand, you know, did you pay for it yet? So that is a danger. I travel with Sheila's, as you know, I go around Sheila's, so I definitely have to make sure. My standard is that I don't eat unless they eat. Yeah, that's my standard. I won't. They have to eat at least as opulently as me, or preferably more opulently. I mean, some places I'll put them on the altar and I don't cook for them, and they eat on the altar, eat more opulently. So that's my standard. And having the Sheilas or deities, and that is also a traditional thing that sannyasis would travel sometimes with deities. Many sannyasis, I know Gopal Krishnamurti, he has many Sheilas he travels with. And that keeps your consciousness fixed. I find that really helps me a tremendous amount. And every morning I do my puja for the deities, and it helps me focus my mind. I listen to Prabhupada's class while I'm doing the puja, and that helps my Krishna consciousness tremendously. So,
I listened to a class by Srila Prabhupada yesterday, Atlanta, 5th of March, 1975. There's a lady in the audience, and she says, is it better, is it less, is it less bad to eat plants? But she even said, but you're also killing plants.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I thought Prabhupada would say, well, it's, I think the Ahimsa principle is less violence, it's better.
Mm.
He didn't say that. He said, no difference. You kill plant, sinful. Mm-hmm. You kill animal, sinful. As long as you don't offer it to Krishna, it's all the same.
It's all the same, yeah.
It was quite kind of surprising to hear it that drastically. But it's reflected here again. It says, if you cook for yourself, sinful reaction.
Yeah. It's in. You're barely eating sin, even if it's...
One who cooks foodstuffs for maintenance of his body takes in all kinds of sin.
Yeah. If you don't offer to Krishna. So that's why Prabhupada said we're not vegetarians.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually Krishnarians. I mean, I've heard that. I don't know if that expression specifically comes from Prabhupada, but we eat food offered to Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
We're not simply interested in talking about vegetarianism to people. Although... technically, if you get down to the karmic thing, it's less sinful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's less sinful, obviously. Prabhupada did make that point in other places, too.
Another place, yes.
Yeah, that it is less sinful. But according to the circumstance, Prabhupada made different points. obviously less sinful to kill a plant than to kill a cow. I mean, even amongst meat, killing a cow is worse, more sinful than killing a goat. The Prophet said, if you have to eat meat, you eat a lower creature, like a goat, or, you know, even there's dog eaters.
Monkey.
Monkey eaters?
Monkey brain meat.
Monkey brains.
But Maharaj, I just got an email this morning. You probably have seen it as well, from Rasaraj Prabhu.
No, I haven't seen
it. You haven't seen it yet. It's called Something Just Came In. It's the latest thing now. The scientists in laboratories, well, not scientists.
They're growing hamburgers.
They can now make meat perfectly.
Yeah.
It's not from animals.
Yeah.
Now, a lady wrote something to Rasaraj and he sent it to the leaderships and the directors and whatnot. So, how do we deal with that now?
First of all, it is from animals because the original stem cell they're using, I have already investigated that.
Okay.
The original stem cell they were using is coming from an animal. So it's not that they're creating life.
No.
They're actually growing animals in the laboratory. I mean, growing the flesh in the laboratory. It's still flesh.
There must be a soul in here.
Yeah, there's a soul in every cell of the body.
Yeah, but no primary soul.
No, there's no primary soul. It's not a big thing. But they're taking the stem cells. You know what a stem cell is. And they're growing. I actually investigated.
What is a stem cell?
The stem cell is the cells in the... that can grow into any organ of the body.
Wow.
They're just like when the egg and the sperm, they meet and everything's fertilized, then you have these stem cells which are undifferentiated cells. In other words, they're not yet specific organs. Mm-hmm. And what
determines
the genes.
The genes.
The genes, you know, the DNA.
So when you cut your nose and then there's a stem cell involved in replacing?
No. You don't. If you cut your nose off, your nose won't grow back.
No, but other parts. If I cut a part of my finger, it grows back.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes.
And there's some worms, yeah. In those cases where it grows back, there's stem cells.
There's stem cells involved.
So the scientists are trying to tweak these stem cells from embryos so they can regrow like hearts and different things like that. And what they do with these stem cells is they make an armature, they make a form like an ear or something like that and have the stem cells grow around it to create a new ear.
And that works?
That's what they say.
And now they use the same thing for food?
Yeah, but right now they're not so expert, so each hamburger is like $20,000 or $30,000 it costs them to make.
But that has changed now. They have revolutionized a few things.
Oh, they did it better now?
Yeah, they got it down.
But it's not, the main point is not offerable to Krishna.
That's...
It's not that we're going to go, Hari Bol, now I can eat meat, you know, just grow it in the laboratory.
Now, this with the stem cell is a good point. Very good.
Yeah, the stem cells are undifferentiated and they can become anything.
So it is actually animal.
Yeah, they haven't created...
It's just multiplied.
That's right. It's like, you can't create life from dull matter.
Yeah.
Life comes from life. I mean, that's
our philosophy. Prabhupada says in the purport, you can't make milk, water, vegetables in your laboratory. He says that.
Yeah.
Right? The prime necessities of life, grains, vegetables, milk, water, are supplied for mankind by the Lord... and such foodstuffs cannot be manufactured by any scientist or materialist in a laboratory or factory established by human effort.
That's right.
So even that meat here is not that made by the lab in the lab.
No, they're not creating it just from the chemicals.
Right.
I mean, life is coming from life. It's like you have test tube babies, you know.
Right.
But it's not that they put a little bit of this chemical and that chemical. They can't even create a proper dog. They can't even create an egg. You know, so it's just that they take the original, you know, the test tube baby has this sperm in the ovum there, and they put them together. And it's an artificial womb, but they're not creating it.
So this new thing does not create a problem for us in the ethics or whatever, not because that was the question of this.
Why would it be ethical?
Yeah, I was wondering that too.
I mean, I wouldn't do it.
Aren't they taking from the newborn calf the stem cells?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're taking from the newborn calf or
embryos.
That's where the stem cells come from.
Yeah.
Stem cells are the undifferentiated cells in the beginning of life.
They're killing anyway.
They can become anything. You know, it's just
I mean, life comes to life. I mean, maybe they kill one calf and then they can produce millions of hamburgers from it in the hamburger factory. There was even one movie many years ago, I forget, something green.
Soylent Green.
Where they were feeding people.
What's it called?
Soylent Green. It was all people.
They didn't tell people what they were feeding people. They were giving people pills, and they were actually feeding people other people. I mean, it's all cannibalism anyway. And it's unofferable to Krishna, I mean.
I have another question.
Yeah.
In some parts of the... In some purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that the soul comes to the rain, into the grains, into the semen. I've heard a lecture not long ago where Prabhupada said it's not like that.
The Prabhupada said not like that.
It's not like that. It doesn't come to the rain, grains, etc.
So.
And I always wondered, how can it come through the grains? If I never eat grain, I cannot not.
Can't have children.
Cannot have children. It doesn't work like that.
Come a brahmachari. So. by grains, I guess that's a generic term for plants.
For what?
For plants, any sort of plants, you know, like we have plants that are not grains, like buckwheat, things like that. And I didn't know that Prabhupada said that it doesn't come.
Yeah, I was so surprised.
Because I heard Prabhupada say it does come from.
I'm sorry?
I heard Prabhupada say it does come from the grains.
But now I heard that he says it doesn't. And I've always had a problem with this idea that it has to come to the rain, to the grains, to the semen, etc.
I don't.
Okay.
Technology I'm not aware of.
Okay.
It's not one of my expertise. Material technology, I mean, gross technology, you can ask me any question you want. Because I was a scientist before I joined the movement. You can ask me how to make an atom bomb, you know, I know how to do that. But these other things beyond me.
Hi, Nanda. Gurudev, I have a suggestion for this topic, because it seems from Bhagavad Gita at least that this particular cycle is not describing a general process, but is describing how you descend down from heavenly realm.
Mm.
And mathematically, I think it doesn't add up. The supposition
that's true.
That everyone has to come down.
That's true. Yeah, that's actually a good point. That it's for demigods who descend. That's interesting. Yeah, good point. Thank you for that. So, one of the questions before we eat prasadam, and class about prasadam, we're delaying it. So. Yeah.
And now there is a big issue with this milk thing. And what about grains? Because the bulls, they are supposed to produce the grain.
Yeah.
So can you say something about the cow? Because I know, my understanding is that the cows, they are tortured, they are killed. Then they don't give milk anymore. And the bulls, what is the grains? What is the connection?
Well, Prabhupada actually said that unless you utilize the bulls, you'll want to kill them. In other words, you'll be resentful. Just like if you have, let's give you an example, if you're a temple president and there's some lazy devotee in the temple that doesn't do anything, you're going to want to get rid of them. Maybe not kill them. I remember in the early days, when we were starting the temple, we had one devotee who was so lazy, the only thing he could do was go to the store and buy 7-Up to drink. And when I sent him out in Sankirtan, I gave him some sweets to distribute. He ate all the sweets. You know, so I looked in the car, it was filled with these wrappers, you know, Tootsie Roll wrappers in the car. So he's the only devotee I ever hit in my whole life. You know, don't accuse me of being abusive. But anyway, I picked him up by this scruff of his neck. I was young, you know. You know, I've repented since then. So, you know, but I really was angry with him. So if you have a bunch of these bulls who are running around, Prabhupada actually said this, you want to kill them. Because they're just sitting and eating and using up the grains and eating, and or the grass or whatever. So Prabhupada said they must be used. There's quotes like that. They must be used to plow the ground. And so, of course, nowadays, if a calf is a bull calf, they just kill the calf or turn it into, you know, some meat immediately, or whatever. You know, so the dairies are actually like worse than concentration camps. But Prabhupada at the same time, really didn't want us talking about these things that much. I remember one time there was an article in the Back to Godhead that depicted the horrible positions of the dairies and the slaughterhouse, and Prabhupada didn't like it at all. He said, this is not our business to do that. So, but we're aware of that, and so therefore we should have milk that is at least ahimsa milk, produced by cows that are not going to be slaughtered, and cows when they give birth to bulls, the bulls won't be slaughtered either. And that's a real challenge. That's one of the reasons I don't take milk, is because of, it's not ahimsa milk. I couldn't ethically, I'm not, at the same time, I'm not chastising any devotees or saying anything negative about the devotees who take milk. It's just my personal ethical decision.
In the west coast of America, there's a big effort now for ahimsa milk.
Yeah.
Tukaram. Tukaram is really good.
He's into it, yeah.
He's really into it. A lot of devotees, there's a devotee trade now of ahimsa milk in big quantities.
Yeah, Gita Nagari is also producing ahimsa milk right now. But the interesting thing is that to produce ahimsa milk, it's like four or five times the price of regular milk.
Wow.
Because the way they support the milk industry is they kill the cows and then they sell the meat, and they don't have to maintain the cows for the rest of their lives. They don't have to maintain the calves.
Wow.
They turn the calves into whatever.
But it's all interrelated. It's very good what you say, that we have to then also use the bulls.
Yeah.
We cannot only think ahimsa milk. We have to think a little further.
That's what Prabhupada said.
Yeah.
You have the cars.
Yes, we have to give up the cars eventually.
Yeah. I mean, eventually.
And to go back to the bulls.
I mean, Prabhupada wanted the farms to be like that. We do not have many farms, actual farms in ISKCON. What we have are rural subdivisions.
Mm.
You understand what I mean?
Mm.
A rural subdivision means the devotees go there, live peacefully. I know in America, it's not a criticism of anything in Europe. But and then they travel to the city to make money. And or go on the internet to make money. That's not a farm. Prabhupada said simple living, high thinking. Which means
that includes the bull.
The bull. It has to be. Prabhupada made that point many times.
Yeah.
The bull has to be utilized. Otherwise you're going to want to kill him.
Too many motors in this world.
Yeah. Yeah, motors and pollution and everything like that. And technology is not going to solve the problem. You know, the more solar cells and things like that. It's not that that's any greener.
It's not?
Well, you're using less of the fossil fuels at that particular point. But in terms of being greener and natural, it's not natural. I mean, solar cells don't grow on trees.
That's right.
Natural means, Isn't it? I mean, and even the technology is polluting too.
I'm sure it is.
Creating the solar cell.
Consciousness in the end. You get.
And also the electricity. Every one of us is surrounded by like all these electrical fields right now.
Smog, electrosmog.
Yeah, because you have. I mean, people sometimes. I was talking to a devotee in Finland. He turns off his Wi-Fi at night, and I said, but even worse than that is this energy that's everywhere in the wires and the walls. I mean, if you get an old AM radio, you know what an AM radio
yes.
is, and you turn it on to a station that's not a station, and you turn it loud, you can measure the energies.
Oh, can
I? Yeah.
Wow.
And you'll hear this hum. You go around the walls and touch it in the wall. It's a good way to actually detect EMF, a cheap way.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see how much is in the walls and would be bombarded. You know, when I years ago I was living in the forest and I had electricity, but I would turn off the circuit breakers at night and I felt so much more peaceful.
Great.
I don't know if anyone's tried that.
Yeah.
And you just feel like, wow, this is completely different. Because it's affecting us and there's this buzz, this hum that's very subtle. It's just like going into the body and you get cancer or who knows what else happens because of that.
These mobile phone towers there's a powerful...
Everywhere.
There's a powerful beam of beams.
Yeah, and that's also giving people cancer, whatever. Yeah, so we're being affected by this.
Down with it.
Down with it. Well, I'm addicted to it, so... I got two mobile phones here, one recording my class, one broadcasting on Mayapur TV,
Down with the internet.
Down with the internet. Well...
All right, so I think we have to take prasanna now after speaking about prasanna.
Yes.
All glories to His divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. I'm with the internet. Ha ha ha.